Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and campaign vet, policy advocate, and digital marketing consultant Jeff McLean. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Trump administration is planning a slow rollout of its fiscal year 2020 budget proposal. It has been reported that the main budget document and summary tables will be released the week of March 11th, but other supplementary material will be delayed an additional week, including a, quote, major savings and reform document that would detail any proposed spending cuts. The planned release would come 5 weeks after the statutory deadline of February 4th, a delay that could set back the fiscal year 2020 appropriations process. Congress is still trying to wrap up appropriations bills for fiscal year 2019, which are now more than 4 months overdue and the subject of a 35-day partial government shutdown that just recently ended. Only about a third of White House budget staff was working during the shutdown, and those lost work days would have been prime time for finishing a budget request that was due by statute this week. The president's budget blueprint may again attempt to boost defense spending beyond the budget caps imposed under a 2011 deficit reduction law, as administration officials have previously floated defense top-line figures as high as $750 billion in fiscal year 2020, compared to the $576 billion allowed under current budget caps. Congressional leaders will likely negotiate a new bipartisan deal to raise spending caps to avoid deep cuts, but the lack of a new agreement could further derail the appropriations process, perhaps making the 2020 process even more painful than the most recent one that involved a government shutdown. In fact, House and Senate negotiators will be under pressure this week to produce a border security compromise that would avoid another shutdown, with the existing stopgap spending bill set to expire on February 15th. The president has already declined to rule out triggering another partial government shutdown if no compromise is reached. At the moment, there does not even appear to be a path forward on compromise. House Democrats offered a homeland security proposal last week that moved a step backward by containing no money at all for a border wall or physical barriers, and the president warned that any such proposal that omits wall funding would be, quote, a waste of time. President Trump has also suggested he may look past Congress and try to fund a southern border wall on his own by declaring a national emergency to tap unobligated funding for wall construction. Any decision to declare an emergency could upend already difficult congressional talks and set a bad precedent that could encourage any future president to fund priorities by executive order. Not to mention, an emergency declaration is almost sure to trigger a court challenge. In an effort to lower drug prices, the Trump administration is taking aim at manufacturer rebates. While rebates paid to health insurers and pharmacy benefit managers are intended to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, the Health and Human Services Secretary has said consumers aren't the ones benefiting. A proposed rule would dissuade drug manufacturers from offering rebates by removing federal protection for them under an anti-kickback statute. Instead, federal protection would be granted for upfront discounts to patients and flat service fees for pharmacy benefit managers. The rule is receiving mixed reviews, with some saying Medicare Part D premiums would likely rise but be offset by lower drug prices, while others are saying it puts too much trust in Big Pharma to lower those prices. This week, President Trump is delivering the State of the Union address, and the biggest question surrounding it seems to be whether he will in fact declare a national emergency at the southern border. Republicans have been cautioning against such a declaration. During the address, the president may weigh in on ideological issues other than immigration, such as abortion, and he's expected to announce a 10-year strategy to end the HIV epidemic in America. The president is also expected to highlight broad themes such as economic success under his administration, bipartisan efforts on prescription drug costs, and infrastructure investment, effectively framing the speech as a kickoff for his reelection bid. The address may also offer a hint of the fiscal pressures shaping his upcoming budget request for fiscal year 2020. And we will talk more about the president's State of the Union later in the program. Up next, I'll be joined by Jeff McClain to discuss campaign finance, how technology is changing personal finance, and more. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Jeff McClain. Jeff owns a digital marketing consulting firm on the New Hampshire seacoast. Jeff also founded FinTechFreedom.com, a website focused on financial tech, hence FinTech, and how it is impacting personal finance. In a past life, he also worked on various campaigns concerning campaign finance reform initiatives. Welcome to Facing the Future, Jeff.
Thanks, Chase.
I'm excited about some of these topics we're talking about, and let's kick it off by talking about your, quote, past life when it comes to campaign finance reform. Maybe share with our listeners a bit of what you did on the issue, some of the campaigns or initiatives you worked on, and why you got involved in the issue in the first place.
14 years ago, my uncle Sam Schaap, who has since passed away, we were very close. He lived in California. And we spoke quite frequently, really on a weekly basis. And I remember him saying to me once, have you checked out or have you heard of the Concord Coalition? And of course, my initial response being from New Hampshire that, you know, how does Sam know about this little Concord Coalition in Concord, New Hampshire? Well, lo and behold, that was not the case. Of course, Concord Coalition is a national organization. And Sam and I frequently talked about political issues and how things could be changed. And so I checked out the Concord Coalition and the great work that the coalition does regarding our long-term debt and our annual deficit issues. Fast forward a little bit, a couple of years later, I started to make the correlation between our in my mind, the federal debt issues and the issue of money in politics and how, in my mind, as more money gets poured into the political system, you know, additional government spending, in my mind, seemed to take hold. Fast forward a little bit further, I started reading much of what Professor Lawrence Lessig from Harvard was writing on the subject, and he wrote a book called Republic Lost, which was really took a close look at the issue of money in politics, but a large segment of that book was devoted to how money in politics really disrupts the free market and increases the level of spending that our federal government takes on. In fact, one of the good examples that Professor Lessig made in that book was that Intuit, the company that is behind TurboTax, is actually one of the largest contributors to federal candidates. And Larry made the argument in that book that the incentive for Intuit to basically keep the tax code as complicated and as complex as it is was in their favor, because obviously the more complex it is, the more that people would need their software. So, you know, Larry became a very close friend over time, and really that's how I spent my time on the issue.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, that friendship actually developed in you participating or helping Professor Lessig in his brief but probably impactful presidential run during the 2016 cycle.
Yeah, so I did end up working closely with Professor Lessig on that effort. One related issue to that was when Larry decided that he would run, he had made the determination, or I guess we had made the determination, that by focusing singularly on that issue, and then once passing comprehensive campaign finance reform, he would step aside and hand it over to the vice presidency. Of course, it was a crazy idea, but the whole idea behind that was to make sure that the singular focus was on that issue, what he calls the root issue. And so, in hindsight, what we know is that basically the media really grabbed onto that particular piece, meaning the stepping aside, as opposed to what we felt and what we feel and what we know is the root issue, which is the influence that money has on our political system. And of course, I have long been a proponent of tackling that issue, addressing that issue as it relates to our federal budget issues.
And you just mentioned tackling the issue and Professor Lessig's run very much being an issue-based candidacy. Did he put out any potential solutions to the issues? And do you have any of your own since you've studied and worked on this particular topic over the years? Have there been any maybe bipartisan solutions that have been considered or talked about that might be worth acting on?
When I was focused on this issue, I was lobbying for this issue back in 2010. The bill on the floor, the bill then was what was known as the Fair Elections Now Act, which was a bill focused on partial public funding of elections. But again, that issue actually became quite partisan. If you remember back in 2010, 2008, Democrats had taken over both the presidency, the House, and the Senate. But then in 2010, it was Congress went back the other way. Before that new Congress was sworn in 2010, we basically got as far as what's known as a markup within a House committee. We actually didn't even get a House floor vote at that time. And of course, we were expecting that, but it never occurred. We know that this issue is difficult for politicians to sort of move past the current system that they're in, largely because it leads to incumbency rates really in the 80 percentile realm. So it's one of those issues that I feel is quite important, but I've more recently been focused on what we can do on the personal finance side. But I know that those efforts are ongoing, and certainly I know Larry is still heavily focused on that issue.
And I definitely, Jeff, want to get to your focus on personal finance. That's especially one of the areas that I'm interested in as a millennial who's trying to make ends meet and move forward in the world. But before we do that, I had one more question for you. As you were working with Professor Lessig and learning about the issue of campaign finance, and you mentioned how there was some crossover there in your mind as it pertains to issues that are more centrally focused on by the Concord Coalition in terms of fiscal policy and debt buildup and deficits. But when you were in the field, because it was effectively, in many ways, a grassroots effort, much like what Concord is focused on, what kind of reception did you get from the public on some of those campaign finance reform issues?
Yeah, when we did public polling on the issue, it was overwhelming support for comprehensive campaign finance reform. However, you know, that's sort of one of those those terms this can certainly be, the eyes can certainly glaze over when you mention it. But when you talk about the influence, the corrupting influence that money can have on our political system, certainly it's overwhelming. So, in fact, one of the things that Larry and I did prior to Larry's run for presidency is we actually conducted a walk across New Hampshire in January. It was actually an 185-mile walk from Dixville Notch down to Nashua in January, I believe that was 2015 when we first did that. And it was a beautiful walk. We actually started up in Dixville in January, and we finished 21 days later in Nashua. And basically the whole idea behind that was to not only bring awareness of what we were doing in the lead up to, at that time, to the presidential election, but to really go to the grassroots. And as we kind of walked throughout New Hampshire in January, we really were able to see and a lot of the folks and meet with a lot of the public that we wouldn't otherwise be able to by doing that. So that was a great effort, and it was something that we'll certainly always remember.
Yeah, one thing that stood out to me there, aside from the issue and the engagement, was you said it was a beautiful walk in January in New Hampshire. I don't know if I'd put those two things together. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Jeff McClain about campaign finance reform, a little bit of national fiscal policy, and also we're going to start talking about how technology is changing personal finance. And one last question I have for you, Jeff, before we jump down the road of personal finance. You mentioned earlier on that your uncle, Sam Schatz, was someone who had turned you on to the Concord Coalition and the issues that we focus on. In this political dynamic, in this sort of new world of campaign finance we've seen over the last decade or so with money and politics, what do you see as a potential path forward to tackle some of our larger fiscal challenges? Do you think it's possible to see reform on those issues in this current climate?
I do, and I think back on my conversations that I actually had, you know, I had with Sam, who, again, he was incredibly smart and somebody I admired so much. And some of those early issues that we talked about is the issue of gerrymandering and how that impacts the mind or the psyche of politicians. I think it's helpful in many regards to really put yourself in the shoes of your member of Congress. They're now spending the majority of their time, you know, raising money, in fact, raising money from the same interests that they're expected to regulate. And in some instances, obviously not all, but in instances like the example I gave earlier about Intuit, the money that goes in from these private donors, in many respects, are expecting a return on their investment. And the only way that a member of Congress can, quote-unquote, return that investment is through what the federal government does. Today, with 435 members of Congress, I believe the latest number is only roughly around 50 or so districts are considered competitive. New Hampshire, because of its nature, I believe actually has two districts that are not considered, quote-unquote, gerrymandered like others. But if you're in a member and you represent a district that is heavily gerrymandered, your incentive really is to make sure that somebody from your own party doesn't primary you, because the gerrymandering really redraws the districts in your party's favor. So your biggest threat really only becomes in that primary. So what happens is, once you get to the general election, really there's no competition. Thus, there's no incentive anymore for that member to largely compromise. And really, unfortunately, the single largest priority for a member of Congress, which they won't admit, but it's true, is re-election. I think so long as you have these issues floating around, I think it makes it more difficult to address, certainly, the growing annual deficit, which is actually occurring in a time of what many view as certainly economic prosperity and economic growth. All of these issues really kind of flow together, and I think Sam really turned me on to this early on. And, of course, Larry has done a really great job really focusing on this even further.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. It's certainly troubling to see, at a time of economic growth for our nation, budget deficits are also going up pretty rapidly and at incredibly high levels. Let's switch gears here. That was a kind of a rough transition, but I do want to spend some time talking about your latest endeavor, and that's FintechFreedom.com. Maybe break down for our listeners what fintech is. It sounds like a funny word, but it has a specific meaning, and what kind of role it's playing in personal finance.
Sure, yeah, and I think to make the connection, I think, closer to the issue of, obviously, the fiscal issues that we face. One of the things I came to realize, I guess about 2 years ago, was that it can be difficult to focus on the urgent need to address the long-term federal debt and obviously the growing deficits, which we just talked about, when the statistics show that 77% of the public lives paycheck to paycheck, and the average American household, you know, carries a monthly credit card debt of just about $6,900, which equals out to just over $1,000 a year in interest payment. Another interesting stat was that in 1980, the average American carried a debt load equivalent to just double their monthly salary. And today, that number is now five times their average monthly salary. Certainly, with the student loan issues that we have, 44 million Americans now are in student loans, with the average amount owed at just over $37,000. Finally, knowing those numbers, only about 32% of households maintain a budget. The reason I bring that up is because I think knowing those issues and actually just thinking about the impact of those numbers can really drive home the fact that, yes, the federal spending issues are so urgent and we need to address them. But at the same time, the majority of Americans are concerned about their own finances and how they're going to be able to make ends meet at the end of the month. So really, I think honing in on that issue, which is something that I've cared deeply about for a number of years, but then, as you mentioned, which we can certainly talk more about, is this whole new growth in what's known as fintech, which is short for financial technology, and how that can impact and help alleviate some of the personal finance issues that most Americans are facing.
I think the latest government shutdown exhibits a lot of the challenges that you just mentioned, and that was the average American living paycheck to paycheck or carrying an inordinate amount of personal debt or struggling to deal with education-related debt, and how those concerns factor into their daily decision-making, and how maybe, even from my perspective, that's what makes it even more difficult to get the average voter to look at these much larger, much broader fiscal policy issues. What advantage is brought by financial technology?
If you think for a moment quickly about what I would term traditional financial entities, so for example, folks that will help you with your investments or folks that will help you with all of your sort of financial areas, traditionally, they largely have not catered to most of the public. They'll certainly cater to those that have certainly money to invest or don't find themselves in that 77% living paycheck to paycheck. But with the growth in technology, this trend is certainly changing. So with this growth of what we talked about as fintech, what it's done is it's helped to drive down the cost to have access to these services to address those underlying issues, but also it's increased the accessibility and the usability of these tools because, let's face it, all of us today are carrying around these smartphones. We're for better or worse, we're largely attached to them. And so there's from this has come a large growth of really technology to help deal with these personal finance issues. And the same could be said for the government spending issues. I mean, certainly, I think technology will help to address some of this. But we have Congress, which some might agree can hamper dealing with those efforts and implementing technology when needed. But this growth in technology can certainly be both helpful and also really a cost saving for most Americans.
And before we let you go here, Jeff, I have one last question for you. And we're talking about financial technology in a very general or broad sense. Can you just give a quick rundown or maybe even a listing of what some of the tools are that you were describing or referencing that would be considered financial technology?
Sure. So if you visit fintechfreedom.com, you'll notice on the website at the top there's a fintech directory. And within that fintech directory, you can select from a number of different categories, whether it be banking and budgeting, insurance, retirement, real estate, investing, just all of the major financial categories you can think of. And you can visit that and scroll through to see some of the companies that are involved with this. In March, we plan to launch a tool which will enable users to visit the website and input their own personal information in terms of not their name, social, but in terms of where they currently stand in terms of their savings, their amount of debt they have, et cetera. And then once they input that information, it will then put out a recommended list of fintech companies that could help based on that individual's situation. Because I'm like, I'm probably like most, when I walk into a store, I really only want one option to pick from for a shirt. But if there's 25, they may get overwhelmed and decide not to buy any. So I feel the same way about this impact that fintech can have and these fintech companies can have on personal finances for individuals, but I also know that it can be overwhelming. So what I hope to do through both the fintech directory as well as the tool we're planning to launch in March is to help the consumer narrow down those choices that can help them based on their individual situation.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Jeff McClain discuss topics like campaign finance reform, a variety of national fiscal policy issues, as well as technology and how it's impacting or changing personal finance. Thank you for joining the show, Jeff.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages with the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and we'll be discussing the President's State of the Union Address.
Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined in the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Bob is a regular contributor on the program. Welcome back, Bob.
Good to be with you.
Well, today we're discussing the President's State of the Union Address, and I have a feeling it's going to be largely focused on what we didn't hear in his speech. And maybe before we jump into, I guess, what might be the more negative aspect of the address, maybe I'll talk about or mention some of the things he did discuss. He mentioned some calls for bipartisanship in some areas. He touched on the economy, tax reform, immigration, trade deficits, defense spending, even healthcare a little bit. He also called for investment in infrastructure, He did mention the budget, but only to say what he was going to ask for, not what he was going to pay for. And he didn't really spend any time talking about the latest shutdown and how we got there. So I'll turn to you and ask, what was it that wasn't mentioned or really discussed in any detail? Can you give us a quick summary on that?
Sure. I would say this program is facing the future. One thing the president didn't do last night was face the future on the fiscal front. There was really no mention of the debt. I don't think the word was invoked. There was no mention of the annual federal budget deficit. And so, you know, when you talk about all of the, there were some good things. There was an upbeat message about, there were some downbeat messages too, but he also talked about unlimited potential and the need for bipartisanship and, lots of potential for the future, which is all of which is good and true. And he talked about a strong economy. But it all rings a little bit hollow if you don't mention the deep underlying structural budget deficit that is piling up and acts as a shadow over all this. So I was really, I wasn't surprised, but I nevertheless was disappointed that there wasn't a discussion, at least a mention or an acknowledgement that we have a problem of major proportions on the fiscal front, because it really clouds everything else that he talked about.
Yeah, I think if you would like some anecdotal evidence of the words deficit and debt not even being uttered, there was another organization that also focuses on national budget policy that did a debt version of bingo, and most of the Twitter evidence that I saw on the boxes for what they call debt-o, the deficit and the debt, those two boxes weren't marked. So I think you're spot on in saying that they really weren't even referenced. Some other things that I noticed that were pretty absent was there was really no mention of the current state of Medicare and Social Security. He talked about infrastructure, but not really in a way that discusses some of the ways we can pay for any new investments. And he talked a lot about the economy. I didn't know if you wanted to wade into those waters for a second and discuss any of the statements he made, or I guess praises he made of how the economy is performing in his tenure.
Well, he did, and you would expect any president to take credit for some very good economic numbers that have come out in terms of economic growth, job growth, wage growth. Credit belongs there, and you'd expect him to claim it. Certainly he would get blamed if the numbers weren't looking as good. But the thing that we do need to remember is that the economy has just had a shot of adrenaline from a big tax cut, and Congress raised the spending caps last year. So, you know, a lot of economists who look at this say that the sugar high shouldn't be confused with a sustainable trend. And if you have a so-called economic miracle, which he talked about, you have to look at whether or not it's sustainable. And that's where I wish that there was some way that there could be sort of a fiscal response or a fiscal reality check on this, because we have a good economy fueled by very, very large budget deficits and very, very low interest rates. And, how long that's going to go on without some negative consequence is, that's a big question. But here's something that I think people should focus on, is that this is a very, very rare instance where the budget deficit, the national debt and the annual budget deficits are growing, not just in dollar terms, but as a percentage of the economy, growing even though the economy is doing well and the unemployment rate is low. And this is a very, very unusual and somewhat alarming circumstance. So much so that the Congressional Budget Office, when they just did their latest budget and economic outlook, really went out of their way to point that out and to raise an alarm about that and to show how very rare it is. So yes, the economic numbers are good. We should all be happy about that, that things are going in the right direction. But there are these structural issues in place that the president didn't acknowledge last night. So, you know, I would have liked it if at least he has said, you know, things are going well, but we must look to the future. We must face the future, if you will. And here are these problems. We know that we have our health care and retirement programs are growing faster than revenues. And so, you know, we have to do something to bring our budget to a sustainable level. Otherwise, the debt will go to unimaginable, you know, levels. And this is going to negatively affect future generations. I would have taken a platitude over nothing.
Yeah, Bob, you make a great point. In fact, I'm reminded of the interview we did with you and I think Diane Lim a couple of weeks ago, sort of as a precursor to all this, talking about the fiscal state of the union. And I remember you saying that if you happen to be giving a fiscal state of the union, you'd probably be a little more negative than most. And I think this recent state of the union by President Trump was really an indicator of maybe those rose-colored glasses that you've mentioned in the past, really focusing on what he perceived as a lot of highlights and not really connecting with the reality of our fiscal circumstances, those underlying structural issues that you mentioned. And CBO certainly highlighted in their 10-year budget outlook that just came out. You mentioned a phrase that the president stated during the speech, and that was that we're experiencing an economic miracle, that an economic miracle is taking place right now. And he followed it up by saying the only thing that can stop that economic miracle is effectively foolishness, politics, and partisan investigations. And we don't have to get in the investigation piece. But my question to you is, do you agree that those are the only things that could stop our economic growth? Or is that really only part of the answer?
Well, I think that the thing that he left out there is fiscal irresponsibility. I think that plenty of countries have seen economic miracles, or in fact, state governments within the United States have seen so-called economic miracles turn out to be not so miraculous after all, when you realize that they were fueled by sugar highs or large unsustainable borrowing. It's you know, you can goose up an economy with debt, and certainly, that's part of what's going on now. There's underlying strength in the economy too, but we're I think that he left that out. I don't think those are the only things that could bring us down. So it gets to the larger point that we were talking about of things that were just left out of the speech.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby. We're discussing the President's State of the Union address and some of the things that were left out of that speech. And I mentioned, Bob, earlier that President Trump didn't really focus on things like Medicare or Social Security. He touched on healthcare a bit, primarily focusing on pharmaceutical drugs and measures that have been utilized to diminish or reduce costs there. What else would you have hoped that the president would have discussed in terms of healthcare specifically?
I think he should have talked about the underlying growth of healthcare costs, how that affects the federal budget, and how the federal budget can in turn be used to help control underlying healthcare costs. You know, Medicare and Medicaid, the biggest federal programs by far, are great mechanisms for trying different ways of controlling healthcare costs, whether it's through delivery reforms or different treatment methods. And so the federal government can use its authority through these programs to try experiments to see, you know, what works on controlling healthcare costs and what doesn't. And in fact, those experiments are going on in some some show promise and some don't, and they get into very technical stuff that we don't need to get into now, like bundling or things, bundling services. Anyway, without getting into that, I think it would have been great if he had said, we have a healthcare cost crisis. Let's talk about that. The biggest programmatic threat to the federal budget is the growing cost of healthcare. Because we have an aging population that consumes more healthcare. And if we continue to have a healthcare system that spends so much more per person, per capita, than other countries, with not substantially better or in some cases worse results, we're never going to be able to get control of the budget situation. So he could have teed that up as a big issue for discussion. He didn't. He really, aside from the vague mention of pharmaceutical prices, and almost everybody's going to say, yeah, you know, we got to bring down drug prices. But there's a lot more to it than that. And if the president is the one who can use the bully pulpit to spark a national discussion about big issues, he certainly missed an opportunity on healthcare.
And you might agree with me. I think he missed an opportunity to talk a bit about Social Security. Obviously, a lot of healthcare spending in our nation falls into Medicare and Medicaid, which are mandatory spending programs. Social Security certainly falls into that category. We've discussed ad nauseum how mandatory spending is eclipsing a lot of other aspects of the federal budget. He didn't talk about Social Security at all. What would you have hoped he could have used the bully pulpit to say in that environment?
Well, I think in a way that's totally nonpartisan and thoroughly fact-based, he could have lifted from the Social Security trustees report to point out that we also have a problem. I wouldn't call it a crisis, but there is there's certainly, it might not be a crisis for me at my age. It's more of a crisis for you because what we're doing, the actions that we take now with regard to Social Security will determine whether or not it is sustainable in the future. And so even though the program is paying out more than it's taking in now, which is an important inflection point, the Social Security Trust Fund has a claim on the budget. Even that will run out, and that's just really a matter of the government promising to pay itself money. But even that promise runs out in the early 2030s, and we need to begin preparing now to make that program, that very important program, sustainable. So again, the president missed an opportunity to tee up a problem, and many presidents have used the State of the Union address to try to do this. Certainly President Clinton did, President Bush tried to do it. President Obama talked about the long-term fiscal outlook. And, you know, again, President Trump took a pass on teeing up an important issue, which he could have done in a thoroughly nonpartisan way, just to point out the facts and say, here are the numbers. And we have to come together and figure out what to do about this for the good of the nation, for the good of the future.
Well, and speaking of facts and numbers, I think one of the few numbers I heard was a reference to what he put out as money that's been spent really in the defense spending category, but on foreign wars in recent decades. And I'm sure we could debate whether that number was actually accurate. But he also discussed things like the recent tax cuts and the potential for infrastructure investment, and I'm sure as part of his budget proposal coming up in March, we might see a push for an increase in defense spending as a whole. I wonder if an opportunity was missed on talking about ways to pay for some of those things, and I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he did talk about a couple of areas. He just kind of threw it out there without much discussion of things that he wanted to pay for. He didn't talk about anything that we might do in terms of cutting back on spending or raising taxes when you've got a trillion-dollar deficit for as far as the eye can see. it might be an opportunity to talk about, hey, maybe there are some areas that we could spend less in, or that we could raise some more revenue so we're not running these enormous budget deficits. All he talked about was raising spending and, you know, continuing the tax cuts. There wasn't much of a discussion at all. As you say, the budget is coming up in March, so we'll see, you know, more details at that point. But the State of the Union address is an opportunity, and many presidents, so this is standard procedure, have used the State of the Union address to sort of, you know, give a preview of their budget thematically to show where we're going. So I guess, you know, I mean, there was a reference to higher defense spending. That's going to be a big fight. I'm sure that the classic deal out there is that the Republicans and Democrats will agree that there'll be higher defense spending and there'll be higher non-defense spending, and they'll reach some sort of an agreement on that. I don't want to get too technical, but there's a budget cap that goes into effect for this next fiscal year, 2020, that they're going to start working on. It's left over from a budget law that they passed in 2011, and every year they've just sort of been incrementally raising the caps. But the cap for 2020 and 2021 has never been raised, and so what you get is an automatic spending cut of about 10% in the appropriations programs. Well, if you think this year's appropriations were tough, wait till they start on the 2020 bills, because they have less money to deal with. And so Congress on both sides, they want to strike a deal to raise the spending caps. And the president is saying, fine, on defense, I want to raise the caps. I want to go way beyond the caps, but we're not going to raise the defense, the non-defense caps. We'll let the 10% cut go into effect. Well, that's not going to fly. So, you know, I mean, politically, there's going to be a big fight over that. And we'll have to wait for the president's budget to see how that plays out.
Well, it sounds like in many respects, at least on fiscal policy, the State of the Union was really a missed opportunity to use that bully pulpit, like you mentioned, Bob, to really face the future on a lot of the challenges our nation is facing. And we may see some of those challenges rear their head in the next budget appropriations process. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss the President's State of the Union Address. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob.
You're welcome, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts.
Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Expressions of concern about the deficit are not always what they seem. I think this is an appropriate reminder on the heels of the President's State of the Union address, a time of tax cuts, growing deficits, rapid increases in spending on debt service, and a need to address challenges in Social Security and Medicare. Almost every politician at the national level has expressed concern at one point or another about the federal government's budget deficits. They have likely even expressed a need to pay for new spending initiatives or even acknowledge that mandatory spending programs need to be put on a more sustainable fiscal path. But one clear takeaway from the past 25 plus years is that these concerns are often situational and quickly abandoned as soon as they become politically inconvenient. Most legislation has some fiscal impact, either in cutting taxes or increasing spending. Often, budgetary concerns expressed by a bill's opponents are sincere, but sometimes critics of the underlying policy will use its effect on the deficit merely as a club against it. Their concerns then dissipate as soon as it comes time to consider deficit finance proposals that they support. Many Republicans, for example, expressed deep concern over budget deficits during the presidencies of Democrats Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. But when a Republican president took office, many in the GOP had a change of heart and supported tax cuts, a new Medicare prescription drug benefit, and two military engagements, all deficit financed. Today, many Republicans who were fierce fiscal hawks under President Obama have passed large tax cuts without offsets, even though the economic case for it is far weaker than when either Presidents Obama or George W. Bush took office. But Republicans are not alone in such behavior. Democrats, many of which criticize the deficit impacts of large tax cuts or spending policies under President Bush and now President Trump, had no qualms about extending several of them under a Democratic president. Many Democrats also now advocate massive expansions of programs like Medicare and Social Security without practical plans to pay for them. Politicians should be judged by their actions, not their words. When one talks like a deficit hawk only to turn around and support expensive legislation that adds to our growing national debt and annual deficits, the only logical conclusion is that their past budgetary concerns weren't what they appeared to be. For the first time in our nation's history, sustained trillion-dollar deficits during a time of economic growth are on our doorstep. The publicly held national debt is on pace to reach 93% of our economy within a decade, and in just a few short years, the nation is projected to be spending as much on interest as it does on national defense. And those numbers are based on current policies, not new or extended tax cuts or the addition of unpaid-for programs or benefits. No matter your political persuasion, it is time for action that puts our nation on a more sustainable fiscal path. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.